This is WNYC, AM, FM, and HD, New York.
In the second hour of today's Leonard Lopate Show, Mark Bouton talks about how the U.S. military developed new strategies to fight al-Qaeda after 9/11 and how those new approaches led to the raid in Abbottabad and the death of Osama bin Laden last year. And then the Huffington Post's Joshua Hirsch describes the U.S. role in Afghanistan today, whether the U.S. presence is helping to keep violence there in check and why we may not hear very much about Afghanistan in tonight's presidential debate. The news is next. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Lance Armstrong has no place in cycling.
That scathing indictment today from the head of the International Cycling Union, which has stripped Lance Armstrong of the 7 Tour de France titles that made the cyclist and cancer survivor a legend. Pat McQuaid says the evidence is overwhelming that Armstrong engaged in doping, a practice that he says he's been trying to end since he became president.
If I have to apologize now on behalf of the UCI, what I will say is that I am sorry that we couldn't catch every damn one of them red-handed and throw them out of the sport at the time.
Armstrong maintains he never used performance-enhancing drugs, but he decided to give up fighting a system that he says was rigged against him. President Obama and former Governor Mitt Romney will meet for their third and final debate tonight in Boca Raton, Florida. As NPR's Mara Liasson reports, the subject of tonight's encounter is foreign policy.
Tonight's debate, moderated by Bob Schieffer of CBS News, will give the president a chance to explain the shifting stories his administration has offered about the circumstances surrounding the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Mr. Romney will get a chance to offer a better critique on that issue than he did in the last debate, and also to explain what he would do differently than the president on Iran, Afghanistan, or the Middle East. A new poll by the Pew Research Center shows the president's advantage on foreign policy shrinking. 47% of voters favored the president on foreign policy, and 43% favored Romney. Just a month ago, Romney trailed Mr. Obama on these issues by double digits. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
The two jailed members of the Russian punk group Pussy Riot have been sent to the prison camps where they will serve out their 2-year sentences. Peter Van Dyke reports from Moscow that the two women will be held far from the capital despite lawyers' attempts to keep them close to their young children.
The Pussy Riot group said on its Twitter account that Nadezhda Tolokonikova will serve her sentence in Mordovia, about 300 miles from Moscow, with Maria Alokhina in Perm, 700 miles east of the capital. Tolokonikova's daughter is 4 years old. Alokhina's son is 5. The feminist punk group said the women left Moscow over the weekend. Under Russian law, the family must be notified of a move only when a convict arrives at a prison. It was not immediately clear exactly where the women would be held, but Pussy Riot says the authorities chose the harshest possible prison camps. A third member of the band, Yekaterina Samutsevich, was released on appeal 2 weeks ago. For NPR News, I'm Peter Van Dyke in Moscow.
You may recall that the women were convicted for holding an impromptu performance at a cathedral in protest of Vladimir Putin. At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average down 38 points at 13,306. You're listening to NPR News.
And this is WNYC, 60 degrees at 104. Good afternoon, I'm Janet Babin. State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli says he's found conflicts of interest, overpayments, and misuse of credit cards at the State University of New York Research Foundation. The foundation handles millions of dollars in public money, and it supports SUNY campuses and research. DiNapoli says the foundation has taken advantage of lax oversight to cheat taxpayers and skirt the law. He says one employee charged $130,000 to the agency credit card for travel to Asia and hockey tickets. Well, tonight's final presidential debate focuses on foreign policy, as you've been hearing on WNYC, including the threat of terrorism. That issue came up last week after officials in New York arrested 21-year-old a 21-year-old Bangladeshi man for allegedly attempting to blow up the Federal Reserve Bank. Professor Abraham Wagner is at Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs. He says he'll be listening for candidates tonight to acknowledge changes in terror threats since 9/11.
Terrorist threats are there. People are trying to do evil. It's just changed a good bit. You know, do they have an appreciation for how it's changed, and do they have an approach to dealing with it? I want to hear what they've got to say.
WNYC's debate coverage begins tonight at 8. Two New York women who say they were turned away from a potential wedding site because they're lesbians have filed a discrimination complaint. Melissa Irwin and Jenny McCarthy of Albany filed the complaint last week. They say the venue, Liberty Ridge Farm, told them they couldn't hold their wedding there. Liberty Ridge did not immediately return messages. Mostly clear and cool tonight, low 54. Right now, sunny, 66 degrees. WNYC, it's 106.
Support for NPR comes from LifeLock, offering LifeLock ultimate bank account monitoring and supporting NPR's monitoring of world events. Details at LifeLock.com/public radio.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Americans celebrated in May of last year as word spread that the world's most wanted terrorist had been killed. After almost a decade, the man responsible for the September 11th attacks had been brought to justice by a small group of elite American forces. Mark Bowden, whose previous books include Black Hawk Down, has written about why this operation was a success. In his latest book, The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden, which is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Mr. Bowden, the author of 9 books, writes for Vanity Fair and The Atlantic, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hey, thanks.
Did you follow the search for Bin Laden before he was killed?
Well, I think as much as any American did, probably a little more than most, because I sometimes talk to people in the special operations community or the CIA. Because of the work I do, I run into people who are more likely to know something. I was kind of following it closely.
But you weren't thinking about this as a potential book.
No, I never did, actually, until the day that Bin Laden was killed. A friend who is a producer in Hollywood called me. I was in Los Angeles, and he asked me if I was interested in working on researching and writing a screenplay about this. And I thought, yeah, because those of us who've written nonfiction books and screenplays know that the book takes a whole lot more work. And I figured for a screenplay, I could kind of rely on the work that other talented journalists would do. And so I emailed Jay Carney at the White House just to put in a bid to talk to people there, and was really delighted and surprised when he called me right back and said that they would be interested in working with me on it. So,
but your name does carry some weight.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of other talented reporters whose names carry more weight than mine. But in this case, the producer subsequently backed out. They dropped their interest in it. And so I ended up with this potential access without any venue. So I called my publisher.
Well, Black Hawk Down was published 6 years after the fact, guests of the attire close to 3 decades after the Iran hostage crisis. And this one came out as quickly as a movie script might have. Has there been a movie script? Can we expect a movie?
There already is this film that Catherine Bigelow is directing that I think is scheduled to come out later this year. I've not sold the movie rights to this book, and I have no plans to work on a film.
And the Catherine Bigelow film was supposed to open soon, but people saw it as a political issue, and so it has been put off until after the election.
That's probably wise.
Yeah. Well, do you see this book as perhaps having any kind of political impact?
I'm sure it might. I know my publisher, people anticipated that I would be asked, why are you putting out this book right before the election? The honest answer to the question is because I'm slow. My publisher would like for this book to have been the first book. Actually, it turns out it's like the fourth or fifth. I didn't set out to do a book that was going to take me 4 or 5 years, because I knew that the opportunity to really kind of work closely with the men who went on the mission would take years to get to. So it's really more of a story about, how Bin Laden was found. I really think the story is more of an intelligence triumph than anything else. But without a doubt, the president looks very presidential. I think he Anyone who reads the story would conclude, I think, that he handled this with great care and professionalism, and, you know, he looks impressive in it, no doubt.
You mentioned the other books. A Navy SEAL who was on the raid of the Abbottabad compound published a book earlier this year. Have you read it?
I have, yep.
Do your accounts differ in any way?
In very small ways. You know, I was mostly heartened because, you know, no member of that team prior to this fellow had spoken about it. And so, you know, my accounts were based on people within the special operations community, but frankly, no one who was present. And so when this account came out, I read it with a little bit of trepidation. I thought, well, you know, what if my version of events is like wrong, you know? But it turned out it was right in nearly every particular, except in the details of the final shots that killed bin Laden. He had a slightly different version of events.
And that has been a subject of controversy.
It has been, and I think probably you'll hear more because, you know, it strikes me that in an incident like this, as in the years to come, other members of that team speak out, you're probably going to get minor disparities in their accounts.
Well, if you just ask my brother and I what happened over dinner when we were kids, even though we were both there, you're going to get very different stories.
Exactly.
He's received threats, and not my brother, but the Navy SEAL, from the Pentagon for publishing classified information. Mm-hmm. Was that a problem for you as well?
No, it wouldn't be really for me. I mean, I suppose it's possible someone could threaten me, but I'm a journalist, and, you know, I...
Different rules?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember once I was asked to speak at a CIA conference, and I said, sure. And I was called back the next day and asked what my security clearance was. And I said, you've got to be kidding. I would have like a negative security clearance. As a journalist, I've signed no oaths. I have no legal responsibility to protect information. Quite the contrary. You know, my role is to try to find out as much as I can.
In Guests of the Ayatollah and Black Hawk Down, you told the stories of failed U.S. special operations missions during the Iran hostage crisis and in the Battle of Mogadishu. What was different about the killing of Osama bin Laden? Why was this operation a success?
I think it's because luck plays a role, and it's also the talents and experience of the special operators involved is far, far greater today than it's ever been. You know, whether you approve of the invasion of Iraq or not, the fact that American special forces, special operators in particular, have been at war for the last 10 years means that you have veteran members of these units who have literally conducted thousands of raids like these. And so that has never been the case before in history. So I think that's a major reason why this went off so smoothly.
Also, technology, the internet.
Without a doubt. All of that. I mean, and in fact, you know, as I said earlier, I think that the more remarkable story here is how bin Laden was found. And that's where, you know, all these remarkable advances in technology come into play.
Well, you recount the discovery of a suspected terrorist Rolodex and equate it with discovering a huge cache of weapons in previous wars.
Right, or the battle plans of your enemy because, you know, in that case, this was a raid that took place in during the Iraq War where special operators found the mother load of information about every terrorist who had migrated to Iraq through Syria in the previous like 5 years. There were like 500 characters there, and that was like a roadmap to an invisible network. And that's, I think, the key to understanding how we're fighting now is making these invisible networks visible.
Is there some irony in the fact that al-Qaeda often complains about Western technologies and the hegemony of the Western culture and then winds up messing itself up by sticking everything a disk or?
I guess it was a hard drive. They found, the computer database that had all this information stored in it. But, you know, the organization of al-Qaeda that was created by bin Laden, as opposed to these sort of local militias who fly that flag now, the original al-Qaeda existed as an internet phenomenon. I mean, the way that they were able to ship money all around the world, the way they were able to communicate, the way they were able to train and recruit, depended on this global telecommunications network. And it also turns out to be their Achilles heel.
My guest is Mark Bowden, whose latest book is The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. But you begin the book on the morning of the attacks on the World Trade Center. Why there? Why not in the beginning of the discovery of where Osama bin Laden was hiding away?
Because I think that's where this story starts. And I think that the effort to find Osama bin Laden was just about a 10-year-long effort. I think the United States had been interested in targeting bin Laden in the years before 9/11, but clearly any of us who lived through those days knows that that became the number one national priority. And that really changed and kicked into gear this whole capability I'm talking about.
Barack Obama wasn't even in Washington at the time.
That's right. He was a state senator in Illinois and someone who had really no occasion to think hard about defending the United States of America or what it would mean to be responsible for protecting the country. And I think in one of the things I try to do in the book is trace his evolution as he stepped further and further into public life, wrestling with the implications of that responsibility.
His rhetoric was quite different from President Bush's after the attack.
It was, and it's been very consistent. I mean, if you go back to 2004, I guess, when he gave actually earlier than that, I think it was in 2003, he gave a speech in Chicago against invading Iraq. And in that speech, he made a point of saying he was not against all wars. And he said that if I had the opportunity to take up arms against al-Qaeda, I would do so. Little did he know that as president, he quite literally would have that opportunity.
People have noticed that he won the Nobel Peace Prize despite that. How soon after the attacks did the national security community realize that al-Qaeda was behind the 9/11 attacks?
It took them just a few hours. And I think the key was, there's a lot of suspicion that it would have been al-Qaeda, but the key was they found the flight manifests of the planes that had been hijacked, and they were able to correlate some of the hijackers with known al-Qaeda.
And there's been an awful lot of bickering about just how much the intelligence community actually perceived bin Laden as a threat, how much information we had about possible attacks. Was this a real botch-up?
Well, you know, it's one of these things that I think is very easy to turn into a botch-up in retrospect. Clearly, there were those in the intelligence community who were very alarmed by the potential of an al-Qaeda attack, although no one knew exactly what to expect. And those people, you know, were very frustrated because they were unable to convince those above them and, the president to make going after bin Laden and stopping al-Qaeda enough of a priority. In retrospect, we can all say we wish that they had succeeded, but that's a little easier to see now than it was then.
And at that time, the American public was barely aware of Osama bin Laden's existence, although he did pop up in newspaper stories.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got to give, as hard as it is sometimes, the enemy credit. The attacks on 9/11 were remarkably innovative and intelligently plotted and planned. They were not, I don't believe it's likely anyone could have foreseen that happening.
And he was very proud of what he had done?
Oh, without a doubt. In fact, one of the passages in my book, which I got from a Pakistani journalist named Hamid Mir, who tracked down bin Laden in Afghanistan just days after the, or weeks after the 9/11 attacks, shows him boasting about, how he knew it was coming and, you know, what a great day it was for him and his followers.
If a Pakistani journalist could have tracked down Osama bin Laden, why couldn't American intelligence have tracked him down?
Well, I think in this case, because the al-Qaeda organization wanted Hamid Mir to talk to bin Laden, they sought him out. They brought him into Afghanistan. That's why he was able to get to him.
You say bin Laden's upbringing was interestingly opposite to Obama's. Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, I think I see Osama bin Laden as someone who embraced a very extreme religious philosophy at a very young age and basically spent the rest of his life narrowing his sphere, living within a very controlled environment where, you know, he basically cut off himself and everyone close to him from the outside world. He lived as an ascetic. Barack Obama is someone whose experience growing up and for his entire life has been international. And if anything, his story is the story of someone who has sought out different experiences in different cultures. And he's a truly, probably the most international man to ever be president of the United States.
Well, both Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush grew up in privileged situations. But Osama's siblings, for the most part, embraced their wealth and position in society, while he didn't.
That's right. And, you know, he was, I think he rebelled against the great wealth of his family, against the westernization of his family. And when I say at a very young age, embracing the extreme tenets of Islam, he was probably a teenager when that happened.
We'll come back to that after we take a little break. My guest is Mark Bowden, whose latest book is The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. We're back with Mark Bowden, the author of 9 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Black Hawk Down. He reported for the Philadelphia Inquirer for 20 years and now writes for Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, and other magazines. His most recent book, published by Atlantic Monthly Press, is The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. You mentioned that, unlike his siblings, Osama bin Laden really got caught up in radical beliefs. What were the inspirations for them, and was his level of extremism unique?
Well, apparently it's not unique. It's not hugely popular. It certainly was less so when he was a teenager, but he was influenced by the madrasas that he attended as a student, by faculty members at the universities in Saudi Arabia where he went to school. He embraced the sort of extreme version of Islam at about the time that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan.
Wahhabism.
Yes, and that that was a rallying call for these romantic extremists throughout the Middle East. And really the formative experiences of Osama bin Laden were going to Pakistan to join the jihad against the Soviet Union, and the kind of remarkable success that he enjoyed in fighting against them.
Should we just think of him as a Saudi, or should we also take into consideration the fact that his father came from Yemen and worked his way up into right. extreme wealth in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, he was, as a young man, basically exiled from Saudi Arabia. But, you know, I see him as a Saudi. I think he was a product of that culture, although he embraced a kind of pan-Muslimism or pan-Islam. When he talks of in his letters the nation, he's not talking about Saudi Arabia. He's talking about the Muslim nation that he hopes to create.
He also was a poet. Were his poems political?
They were religious and romantic and violent. He had this kind of flowery, romantic notion of the glory days of Islam, the days when Arabs ruled the world, and you know, he wrote about warriors on horseback fighting with shields and spears, and so I mean, he had this fantasy, I think, of fighting against the infidels that goes back to the early Middle Ages.
So were his main grievances against the United States simply that we were the leaders of the infidels?
Yes. He believed that the one true path for humanity was the Quran as he interpreted it. And he believed that anyone who wasn't a Muslim was an infidel, and that the powers of the United States and the Soviet Union were trying to destroy the Muslim world. And so he viewed everything from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan to America's role in supporting dictators at various countries in the Middle East to something as simple as the westernization of Arab culture as a plot against Islam.
So it didn't matter whether the United States and the Soviet Union were enemies, and the United States actually were supplying the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
Right. They were both devils in his eyes. And
take the weapons because they're helping you, but don't necessarily be grateful.
Exactly.
In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, how much of a priority was bin Laden's capture? Did the Bush administration make a concerted effort to capture him?
They did. I think that, you know, it became an urgent priority of the United States government after 9/11. I think, though, the means to locate him, the means to trace and locate key players in that organization, it took years to evolve. And, you know, as I said in the book, it drew upon, you know, old-fashioned methods of espionage, recreating human spy networks. It drew upon very advanced surveillance techniques, both from NSA, the development of drones, the application of supercomputers, the development of very innovative software that enabled analysts to tie together things that would not have been connected very readily in the past, and also this maturation of the Special Operations Command.
So was all of that being done under the Bush administration? Because it was my sense, just as an outsider, that bin Laden stopped being a priority at a certain point, that it was just accepted that he'd be off there, we thought, in a cave, mm-hmm. and that he had kind of lost his importance to al-Qaeda.
Well, I think that – I don't believe that the CIA ever let up in their efforts to find bin Laden, and I think that that ultimately finding him is a triumph of those who worked hard on this daily for almost 10 years, and that goes back during the Bush administration. There's no doubt that in the White House, when you're fighting two wars, when the war in Iraq really heated up, it has to crowd out the attention span of those at the highest level of government, coupled with the fact that bin Laden disappeared. And they really didn't know where he was. So at the time, they were telling us that he's probably in a cave in the tribal regions of Pakistan. That was no better than a guess. They had no intelligence about him for years. So they had basically lost track of him. There wasn't anything to report.
My guest is Mark Bowden. His book, The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden, it's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, when he was running for president, Barack Obama said that he was going to make Afghanistan as his top priority. Did that immediately make Osama bin Laden a top priority as well?
Well, I think he also said that he felt that the primary target for the American military was al-Qaeda. He was fairly consistent about that, going back to his earliest days talking about how the United States should respond to 9/11. And when he became president, he began immediately shifting resources from Iraq to Afghanistan, both because he wanted to reemphasize the struggle against the Taliban, but also because, if not more, because he wanted to focus that military effort on al-Qaeda inside Pakistan.
When bin Laden was found and killed, Dick Cheney and others claimed that all of the work leading up to finding him had been done during the Bush years and that waterboarding had played a role in it. Do we have any sense that that's true?
It's certainly true that the hunt for bin Laden, as I said, goes back 10 years and did. A lot of it took place during the years when the Bush administration was there. I think that in answer to your question about waterboarding, very clearly, if you look at the key developments in piecing together where bin Laden was, were extracted from interrogation sessions that involved coercive methods like waterboarding, and in some cases were conducted in foreign countries like Mauritania, other places around the Middle East, where we presume real torture went on. I mean, even
and in Poland, you say?
Well, Poland is where the CIA had these clandestine detention centers and interrogation centers. But Definitely torture played a role in finding Osama bin Laden. But what I won't say, because I don't know it to be true, is that there was never a moment where someone under duress coughed up a key piece of information. The puzzle was put together from a variety of interrogations, and those interrogations did involve torture.
So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times at this interrogation center in Poland, didn't say he's in Abbottabad.
No, in fact, curiously, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was very aggressively waterboarded, gave them misinformation. They were asking him, among many, many other things, you know, who is this fellow Ahmed the Kuwaiti? And he said, I never heard of the guy. You know, or he said something like, well, he used to be part of the organization, but he's no longer involved. And that was so contrary to what other detainees had told them. They suspected, why is he protecting Khalid or Ahmed the Kuwaiti? Why is he trying to steer us away from that guy? Maybe that means that he's really important.
Now, one of the things that we will always associate with the Obama administration is drones and drone strikes. Did they play a role in finding Osama bin Laden?
They definitely did. You know, drones have upped the American game when it comes to surveillance and targeting. So, for instance, once they learned the name, who Ahmed the Kuwaiti was, his name is Ibrahim Ahmed Said, they were able to find him. And one of the reasons they were able to find him is because if you know a person's name, then you can begin to trace family connections, networks. And because of the added capability that drones have given for targeting and observing people, not only were we able to find him quickly, we're able to start watching him. And once you're watching him, you see where he lives. And where does he live? He lives in this very curious-looking compound in a suburb of Islamabad.
So they just followed this guy, and he went to that house. What about the doctor who carried on the vaccination study?
That came later. Initially, they just followed Ahmed and saw where he lived. And then when they learned that he was still, as he told someone in a telephone conversation, with the people he was with before, that suggested that he was still working with Osama bin Laden. They became very interested in that compound. And one of the things that they discovered when they looked more closely was that there was a family living there that never came out except to take children to the doctor. And so the CIA at that point said, okay, well, if the children won't come out to a doctor, let's set up a clinic. And maybe they'll come out and we can collect the needles and we might be able to figure out from DNA if they're related to bin Laden.
And that doctor has been indicted, or has he been jailed or by the Pakistani government?
He was convicted of treason in Pakistan and is serving a 30-year prison sentence.
So a major part of the story is also Pakistan. People wonder whether the ISI knew that bin Laden was there, considering the fact that there was a military base so close by. It's my sense that the general feeling is that they didn't know, but they weren't ready to look very deeply into it.
My sense is that they didn't know. And one of the reasons I think that's true is that bin Laden never left that compound. I think if he was there under the auspices of any kind of official, if there was any official knowledge of his being there or sanction for him being there, he would probably have had occasions to leave. But he never left. And I think that says to me he didn't want to show his face anywhere.
He would also be easily spotted because he's 6'4" in an area where many people aren't very tall.
That's correct.
It was rumored that he was on dialysis. Do we know if that's true?
Apparently not true. I can't say with certainty that he was never treated in that way, but he was certainly healthy enough in his final years to father several children. There was no indication from any of his wives who were interrogated later in Pakistan that he was a seriously ill person.
Do we know what his final weeks were like and his reactions to what was going on in the Arab world, Arab Spring?
We do, because he was writing a steady stream of letters, including one that he wrote just 4 or 5 days before he was killed. In it, he is clearly frustrated by not just the American military effort to dismantle his organization, but I think even more distressed by the uprisings of the Arab Spring throughout the Middle East, which were not motivated primarily by Al-Qaeda or by radical Islam.
So it would have been okay if they had inspired them. It wasn't that he was in support of Gaddafi or of Mubarak. It was just that Al-Qaeda was not playing a major role in it.
That's right. The revolution was taking place. He could see it because he's watching it on satellite TV, but it's not the revolution he anticipated.
Was intelligence positive that the man that they saw inside the compound was Osama bin Laden before they raided?
No. And in fact, estimates of confidence were all over the place.
So the president was faced with all sorts of possible embarrassments.
Oh,
if
the
he said go ahead.
Yeah, the downside of this was just incredible. And the fact that it came off without a hitch is just extraordinary and extraordinarily fortunate, because there's so many ways that this could have become a disaster, not just for the SEALs who went on the mission, but for the United States.
Is that why they didn't just drop a bomb on the compound?
You know, President Obama, I think to his credit, ruled that out immediately because the number of bombs that would have to have been used would have killed so many people, not just all the women and children on the compound, but people living nearby. And it was just with the level of uncertainty about who was there, the president just said, you know, we're not going to do that, and asked and demanded different options.
So what were the challenges of raiding this compound?
The biggest challenge was getting in and getting out without awakening Pakistan's military, because basically, you know, that SEAL team is a very small infantry unit, and they're going into a country that if it responds with force, there's no way, you know, that they can fight their way out. In fact, you know, one of the things that I found very surprising in the story was that Admiral McRaven, the commander of the SEALs, suggested initially that they be prepared to just maybe hunker down in that compound if they were discovered and let Washington negotiate for their release. And the president said, no, if you're going in, you're coming out, beef up that force so that you can fight your way out.
Because the Pakistani military, quite reasonably, not knowing what was going on, might very well just start shooting at these guys.
Without a doubt. I mean, this is an invasion of their sovereign territory.
Didn't the administration want to capture bin Laden and put him on trial?
They did. That's what the president told me, and I believe him, because he's been fairly consistent in arguing that he feels the most appropriate way to handle these high-level terrorists is to try them in a criminal court.
So what went wrong?
Well, I think that what he didn't do, and I understand, I think, why he didn't, was make that a very forceful command to the SEALs. You're sending these men into a very dangerous situation. If you ask them to try and take him alive if they can, that's one thing. If you say to them, I want him back alive and I'm going to be angry if you kill him, you know, that's a different kind of order. And he didn't give that kind of order.
Now, we know from the records of the Cuban Missile Crisis that not everyone went along with JFK's decision. He pretty much had to do it on his own. Curtis LeMay wanted to bomb Cuba into oblivion. What about his decision to go ahead with the raid? Did he make it on his own? Were there people in his staff who said we should not be doing this?
There were some who were opposed to sending in the SEALs, but the consensus of advice that the president got was that we should do this mission and we should do it with the SEALs. He did make the decision by himself, and when he made it over the advice of his Secretary of Defense and Vice President Biden. I learned that subsequently the Secretary of Defense changed his opinion, but that was only after the president had decided to order the mission.
And Joe Biden brags about it during every campaign speech he gives.
Well, in Joe's defense, you know, Joe Biden is the only guy in the room who's Obama's running mate. You know, so I figure that, you know, the Secretary of Defense is going to be considering military issues. The Secretary of State's going to consider the diplomatic issues. Vice President Biden was looking at the political consequences of a failure, and the president was less interested in the politics than in the mission itself.
And he was able to watch it in real time?
He was. Initially, they tried to stop him from watching because there was concern that it would give the appearance that he was micromanaging the mission, but they couldn't really stop him. He found out where the feed was being displayed, and he walked in the room and sat down, and I don't think anybody was about to tell him to leave.
Similar to the events in Mogadishu, this mission also had a Black Hawk down.
That's right. Helicopters, as we've learned over the years, are fragile instruments. They, you know, a lot can go wrong, especially when you fly one for an hour and a half loaded to the gills, and then you're trying to bring it to a hover and fast rope over a walled compound. It didn't work.
How long did it take to find bin Laden once they were inside the house?
It took them about 15 to 20 minutes.
That long?
Yes. And interestingly, the only fire at the SEALs came right at the outset. There was a burst of inaccurate fire, and the SEALs killed the shooter. That was Ahmed the Kuwaiti. Then they began advancing on the house, and they methodically cleared it room by room. So Osama bin Laden is upstairs on the third floor for 15 minutes or more.
Knowing something's going on.
Knowing that these men are going through the house. And the only shots that were fired during that entire period were the shots fired by the SEALs.
Did he kill himself, as some people have reported?
No, he did not. He was shot and killed by the SEALs.
Were any of the SEALs hurt?
Yes, one of the one SEAL who's come forward was slightly injured when in that first round of fire.
Did Pakistani forces respond to all of this gunfire?
No, there was no Pakistani response until they scrambled some fighters only after the helicopters had left Pakistan's airspace.
Neighbors must have been aware that something was going on.
Oh, sure, yeah. People in the neighborhood knew something was happening. They had no idea what.
And when they killed this man, was it immediately clear that it was Osama bin Laden?
The men who were there believed it was, and they're looking at him. It took a while longer to convince the White House that they had the right person.
Oh, there have been some people in politics who've said that the president doesn't deserve the credit he's been given or has given himself for bin Laden's death. What's your feeling about that?
I think he deserves a great deal of credit, both for pushing this as a priority and also for the way he handled this whole episode from beginning to end. There are many people who can fault the president for one thing or the other, but I'd be hard-pressed to fault him for anything that he did during this.
Now, was Osama bin Laden really much of a force in the last years? Was eliminating him ultimately a victory for U.S. national security, or just simply a satisfying kind of revenge?
Well, it certainly was satisfying closure for most Americans to the story of 9/11. I think it was very significant to kill him from a practical perspective, even though he was very isolated from his organization and his organization was falling apart. He was still the center of it. He was the center of gravity. He was their leader. You know, he was the inspiration for them. And I think his death really marked, if not the actual end of that organization as a terrorist network, it is the symbolic end of it.
Do you think that they're looking for Zawahiri right now?
Oh, without a doubt.
Another book, right?
Nope, I'm done. I'm not writing any more stories about manhunts.
Mark Bowden's last book about a manhunt is called The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.